speaking about writing, I remember there was a quote, I don't know who was, I mean, of course, all quotes are attributed to Hemingway at some point, but I only write when I'm inspired. Luckily, inspiration hits always at 9 a.m. in the, every morning. He just sits down and writes.
Write drunk, edit sober.
Yeah, very good, very good. Hey there, back. We are the podcast and I am Michael.
And I'm Radek.
And we are discussing productivity, books we've read, everything that is interesting for us and we think might be interesting for you.
Right. That's what we do. Like a bit of everything. Which is called the podcast.
That's why it's called the podcast, because it's the podcast you should be listening to.
That's the plan, yeah. We try.
Yeah, and actually over the last 50 episodes, we've come a long way from just chatting about anything, about gadgets. And we we really like to talk about books, because I think we both like reading books, which means we like listening to audiobooks, actually. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember in which episode, but you gave me this piece of advice that if I'm listening to an audiobook, after each listening session, I should be, jotting some notes, you know, what I've just listened to. And I have an Evernote note as a shortcut, like that I can access very quickly. I just, after each listening session, I write things down. And especially now that the recent books I've been reading were very, very interesting. So I've got lots of notes, which is helpful then to just, you know, go through them after you've read the book.
Yeah, certainly. And we'll link to the episode when we discuss that and also why we listen to audiobooks in particular and how we got to the like 30 books a year pace for the new listeners.
Yep.
And today we wanted to talk about a book we both recently read, which is called Originals.
Yep. Actually, you recommended the book to me, as far as I remember.
Yeah, I think so. I think I found it through Amazon recommendations and it looked interesting. So I just read it, not expecting too much out of it. I thought it was a lighter read, but there was a lot of good stuff, a lot of good advice in it.
Yeah, I mean, just as I started listening to the book, you know, in the very first chapters, it was very reassuring because the guy was actually giving examples of successful entrepreneurs while actually, telling the story of my life, which was which I found really fascinating. Because in the very beginning of the book, he said that contrary to popular belief, the entrepreneurs, the ones that are actually changing the world and doing really great stuff, are not such risk takers as we think they are. They are it's a balancing act between taking risk and then doing something risky on one side and then doing something not risky on the other. And right. The examples he gave were people who had steady jobs or had secured jobs while still trying to pursue a dream. And it was exactly how Nosby happened, how our current business happened. It was because I had a steady portfolio of clients as a consultant. And up until like 4 p.m., I was working my day job as a consultant. And then after 4 p.m., I would actually put on a badge that I got from a conference, which put Michael Slewinski, CEO, Nosby. And I was the only person in my company. So like, yeah, I was the CEO. Why not? And I was working from 4 p.m. until 7 or 8 p.m. when my wife came from work, like on the side. And it was a side project for the first year of running Nosby. And then after the first year, I decided to actually pursue Nosby full time. So it took me a while and I did exactly what the book said.
Right. So it's like from the very start, Nosby has been profitable from day one. Like the only thing you were risking is your time and attention. Like there was opportunity cost for sure, but it's not as if you just throughout your whole life, just stopped working on at your real job. I mean, you were a consultant, so you're still kind of on your own, but it was already working, right? You already had that. You had a steady income and you didn't give it up, right? You didn't take some bold, ridiculous risks, right? You just tried things on the side and it worked. And if it didn't, it would be fine.
Yeah, and the best thing was that I actually built Nozbe for myself, because I had problems managing my projects with my current clients, so I actually built Nozbe to be able to manage that. So I knew that the product worked for me, but I just didn't know how much it would work for, you know, everybody else, you know, if there will be other right. Michaels in the world to actually, you know, use Nozbe as much as I liked using it. So yes, set up Nozbe on a shared server I already had, which was actually, you know, paid in full by my, you know, day job, you know? So right. I didn't even, you know, invest a dime in a different server or anything like that, you know, in the very first months of Nozbe. So really, it was just my time.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the thing. When we think of entrepreneurship, we sometimes see this ridiculous risk takers that make these bold, super risky moves. And there are some people like that, right? Like if you look at, I don't know, Elon Musk, there are certain places in his history which was like ridiculously risky. I mean, starting both SpaceX and Tesla is like a ridiculously risky idea. Like it's a miracle both of these worked.
Yeah,
and of course, everyone still predicts doom of them, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. But like the point is, there's this idea that all entrepreneurs are like that, and it's not necessarily true, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, most entrepreneurs are not necessarily like that. They take risks, but they're calculated, and they're sometimes less risky than we think. Because if you have a cushion, if you can afford to fail, then you can be risky, but it's not really that risky, because if you fail, that's still fine, right? You're not on the street.
Yeah, and it brings me also to this idea, I mean, to a different example of a blogger that we know from Poland, actually, Michał Szafrański. He's a very famous blogger now, but in Poland. And he had a very well-paid job, and he actually quit his work. He started his blog, but then, of course, for a few months, and then he decided, I'm going to do it full time. I'm going to do it in full. But the only risk he was taking was the fact that he wouldn't, you know, earn money for a few months, right?
Right.
But he knew that if, you know, and he gave himself like time, I think a year or something, to try it out, you know, to be a full-time blogger. And he said that if he, you know, after a year, he wouldn't see, you know, any success coming in and any money coming in, he would just apply for a different job. And because he was, you know, he was good at his, you know, previous job, he knew that he would actually find employment no problem. So the only, you know, risk that he took was, you know, try it out for a year, like do a sabbatical kind of in his and but knowing that he has a cushion, has a financial cushion for the year, and if this doesn't work out, he will just get a different job and everything will be fine.
Right. And an important reason why this is a good idea to like take calculated risk is that most businesses fail.
Yeah.
And if you take a bold risk, then you know, if you do something super risky, then you have you have two problems. Like, not only are you doing something that's unlikely to succeed, and you're doing something super risky, and if you fail, you're really screwed, right? And like the thing about taking like calculated risk and being this entrepreneur that the book describes is that you can afford to fail, because you can try things and do things that are supposedly risky, but they're not so risky because you can afford to fail.
And again, bringing back to my example, right now, after so many years of running Nozbe, people come to me and say, Michael, you've been successful, you have this Nozbe thing, very well done you. Actually, what they don't know is that I actually set up my consultancy, like, you know, I was a consultant from the year 2000, and right. I launched Nozbe in 2007. In the meantime, on the side, I launched three different internet projects. All of them failed. And again, I could fail because I did them also, like on the side, also like in the afternoons. And I tried, I learned something new, it failed, it didn't work. So, you know, I failed my way forward, actually, you know. And then in 2007, I launched Nozbe and it worked. And then I switched, I removed, you know, myself from the consultancy and worked on Nozbe full time. But until then, I had three failures. And as you said, I could afford to fail because I still had my day job to protect me and to just, you know, let me keep trying, keep experimenting.
Right. And since launching Nozbe, there's been, at least I know of, two projects which you've tried, like Nozbe tried. There were different things from Nozbe and they both failed.
Yeah.
But it's okay, right? We tried.
Yeah. I mean, we spent time and money on these things, but they failed. We decided, okay, no problem. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. And keep trying things, and we still keep trying things. I know, even, you know, for us, you know, like the new version of Nozbe can be like a risky, you know, endeavor. So like, but again, it's good that we have the cushion, we have the current customers, we have like a revenue model, so that this way we can also try new things. And I think we owe it to the world to try new things and keep improving people's lives.
Right. Right. All right. But that's just a one minor idea from the book. There's been a lot. So what else have you found interesting?
So something that has been repeated over and over in many other books, like this idea of, you know, the 10,000 hours to become proficient and whatnot, Malcolm Gladwell thing. So that you have, so the idea that you have to spend, you know, 10,000 hours to be proficient in something. It wasn't mentioned in the book, I think, but it brought, you know, I got the idea back, because one of the things that the book mentioned was that lots of geniuses had their best work when they were working the most, you know? So like right. In the time spent and when they were the most productive, like doing most output, lots of the output was rubbish, was really bad. But some of the things were just gems, and then these gems created this person that we know, that we think is a genius now, right? So they were doing lots of, it's like what we do, Radek, I think, you know, when we're doing this podcast, we have, you know, worse and better episodes. The same goes to blogging or to, you know, doing our work, that sometimes, you know, something is really good, something is really, it's not really that good, but because we keep on doing, we keep on shipping things, it's what Seth Godin always says, keep shipping, that some of the things are really great. And I really like that idea because it proves the point that, it's not like these geniuses were born geniuses just because of that. You know, they really, you know, had to try hard, you know, learn things, learn through mistakes, you know, have this cadence of shipping, of doing things to enable them to just to be great.
Right, but it really, for me, it challenged this idea that that quality versus quantity is a dichotomy.
Yeah.
Because it made this quite compelling argument that quality often is a result of quantity, right? If you have this mindset that you can only ship work that's like the best, then oftentimes you end up not shipping at all or shipping so infrequently that you'll never stumble across the thing that's great, right? Yeah. And like one of the key arguments is that we are terrible, terrible at judging the quality of our own ideas.
Oh yes,
right. And so we sometimes like think that things that are great are actually not so great, and things that turn out to be like mediocre, we think like this is a great idea. So we like polish those things we think are best. And sometimes it turns out they're actually pretty mediocre. And the things we ignore, they could be those gems, right? And like, there's a lot of nuance in this, but it's been an interesting like mental model to have that actually, sometimes you shouldn't be too much of a perfectionist, because you have to generate a lot of ideas. You have to create and create and ship and ship and ship, because it creates a greater pool of ideas. Some of them are going to be bad. Even if you're a creative genius, but some of them will be really good. And the more you create, the greater the chances that some of those ideas are going to be really, really good.
I had the pleasure of interviewing one of the of a really prolific writers for the Practive magazine, for the recent issue of Practive magazine. We'll link to this in the show notes. And he challenged me then already before I read the book that people tell him that because he's outputting so many words, it cannot be good. You know, it has to be rubbish, you know? And he proves the point that because he's producing so many words and so many, you know, so many books, actually they are good because he finds a way to actually make them better and better. So, like, I really liked, it's a very good interview with this guy. He was, I was just surprised how many things he challenged. And right. Speaking about writing, I remember there was a quote, I don't know who was, I mean, of course, all quotes are attributed to Hemingway at some point, but I don't remember who was that, but somebody said that, I only write when I'm inspired. Luckily, uh-huh. Inspiration hits always at 9 a.m. Every morning. He just sits down and writes, right? And you know, and that's it.
So actually, I'll mention a book which we'll probably also discuss, which is also on a similar topic. I've just finished, called "How to Fly a Horse," and there's been this chapter which mentioned like the idea of a writer's block, and like actually, the thing about writer's block, it's actually not writer's block. Writer's block doesn't exist. It's write stuff I think is good block. Right, like the problem is that if we have this idea that I can only ship things that are perfect, then we block ourselves. But it's not real. We just have to ship and write more, and like we don't have to even publish all of it. Right, like there's a balance to be struck there. I'm not saying like you shouldn't go too far in this direction either. But it's an important thought to keep in mind. Right, but the idea is that sometimes you have to generate a bunch of garbage that you can have as a starting point and then try to polish that. Or maybe because you wrote it, you'll be inspired to make something better. But don't just like block yourself because you feel like you can't create something that's good.
Yeah, it's really that's why, for example, when you write, I mean, lots of people tell you that when you're writing, don't edit. Just write, you know. Editing right. is a different, it's actually a different, part of brain that actually is responsible for editing. So just don't, don't juggle this, write first and then edit later, So this way you won't be judging what you're writing. You will be just writing. And then, when you're editing, then you will be judging and then you'll be, throwing things away. But but this is also a very important exercise.
Write drunk, edit sober.
Yeah, very good, very good.
There's also been this another idea which I found interesting, which is to procrastinate strategically.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that. Very good.
So that's an interesting concept. Like we see procrastination as like universally bad, but it's more like procrastination is bad for productivity, but it can be good for creativity. Right, like there's been this phrase which I love, which is productive mediocrity. Right, you try to, so it's kind of actually the opposite of the previous thing, right? Like you try to be productive all the time and like create at your highest levels of performance, but you never end up doing something good because you never have time to think. You never have time to let ideas like incubate and think in different directions. You just decide on something too quickly and like set yourself that this is what I'm doing, and then your mind is like locked on it and you won't notice other ideas that might be important.
Yeah, there was also this thing mentioned later in the book, the thing that sometimes we just want to close, this thing of closure. We want to just have a closure as soon as possible. But like I'll just give you a perfect example of procrastination in practice. So based on my history just today and yesterday. So tonight, Polish time, I'm actually doing a webinar for Polish NOSB users about communicating through tasks. And for this webinar, of course, I need to be prepared and I need to have a presentation ready and I need to know what I'll be talking about and everything. So what I did was I actually strategically prepared my work like this. Like yesterday, I did an outline of the presentation. Because, I mean, I have all these bits and pieces, you know, in lots of places. So I decided to do the outline, you know, in the mind mapping software. Yesterday in the afternoon, I spent like, I think, an hour just outlining this thing, you know, what I'll be doing, what I'll be talking about. And that's it. I stopped. I did the outline. I read it through. I stopped. That's it. Thank you. So I let it, you know, sink in. Then today in the morning, I went back to the outline, read it through again. And then I actually did a Zoom conference call with my marketing team and just showed them, I mean, I sent them the outline first. And I ran through the outline and told them what I'll be telling the people, you know, on the webinar.
Right.
Without having the presentation ready yet. I just had the outline. And then after that, I mean, during the presentation, I mean, during my, you know, presentation, running through the outline, they gave me lots of feedback. So I just, you know, put things in a bit different. I mean, this is a good thing of the mind mapping. So I just put things in a different order, added something else, removed something. So we discussed a few things, and then that's it. We stopped the call. I went to get a coffee, you know, again, let it sink in. I came back. And then I started doing the keynote. And then I did the presentation right now. I have it like 99% ready right now. And now I'm doing the podcast with you. So after the podcast, I have to go out. But then I'm going to be, you know, finishing off the presentation and going through it again. So I really divided the time to actually do the presentation. And I'm going to run through the presentation in the evening. So the thing is that, you know, I think... And it's great. And every time I start working on it again, every time I have a few new ideas, I'm changing something else. Like I see how it's getting better. You know, because I divided this into these, you know, procrastination blocks.
Right. So for me, I see this as another proof like why it's important to read a lot and not just sometimes, because there are some like little bits of like very important truth in this idea, but the book I think failed to convey some nuance about this and explain like when you should procrastinate and when you shouldn't, to kind of explain like what the point actually is. And so, for example, as I've been reading How to Fly a Horse, there's been some like partially contradictory ideas to this, but they were not really contradictory. They were like they were adding to each other. They were complementing each other. And so what I mean is, it's an important idea, but you have to know when to procrastinate strategically, right? Like when you have something that you just have to do, don't procrastinate, right? Because you need productivity.
Yeah, right.
And so you have to do it. And don't procrastinate to just start. Because again, you have to create a lot of things. And you can't just wait for the moment of inspiration to create something great. You have to work and work and work and work, right? But then I think the key idea here is that you have to deliberately stop like halfway through the process. When you already started the work and you already have some possible directions in which to go, you already have a first draft or first whatever, and then you need some space, right? So you need some space to let those sink in, to allow yourself not to like pick the thing you think is best at the moment you write it, but when it already becomes neutral, when you don't feel like, oh, I just made it, this is the best idea, like no, let it sink in and let you know, let yourself like randomly come up with new ideas to, like, promote divergent thinking, like in different directions to solve the same problem, and then like try to integrate again. So like procrastinate strategically, like that's the key word.
I mean, just like in my example, you know, I did an entire outline yesterday. So I just didn't, you know, start a little bit and whatnot, you know, and then I just decided not to do it. No, I did the entire outline of the entire presentation yesterday, the entire thing. But then after I had done, I paused, I stopped, you know, and then I reviewed the outline with my team, and then I stopped, and then I started doing the I did it in chunks. And I think this is something that that the author is saying. And on top of that, we talked about morning rituals in one of our past episodes, and one of the key ideas of morning ritual and evening ritual is that, for example, what I do every night is I put my three most important tasks for the next day. I write them down in my journal in the evening, again, because I want them to sink in when I'm sleeping. So like in the morning, I'm focused on these three tasks. I have them in front of my eyes, and I have them because I've been, you know, sleeping over them in the meantime.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not so sure if this is an actual thing. I think the key here is that you've pre-decided on something, so you don't have to make the decision in the morning.
That's true.
But maybe you're right. Maybe it does help, like, just for this reason also.
Well, that's what they say.
That's what they say. So another thing I found interesting. So there's been like another like section of the book about voicing and championing new ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really struck me was this notion that agents of change really tend to under communicate their vision, right? And there's been this metaphor. It is like when you ask someone to think of a melody they know and like just tap it out on a table with your fingers, and when you do it, like, you hear the melody in your brain as you're tapping it out, so you feel like it makes sense, it's good, right? I'm good at this. But then other people, they don't hear the melody, they don't sit inside your brain, they only hear the tapping, and they very rarely can actually recognize what the hell you're trying to tap out, right? And like, this metaphor was meant to say is like, people who have new ideas tend to like share tiny bits and pieces of their ideas and vision, and can be frustrated that there's no change, that people don't get it, that people ignore it. But the thing is that we really tend to under-communicate it. We see in our brains more than people on the outside. And so we have to expose people to more and more things, right? You have to mention it, you know, briefly at first and then again and again and explain it. And then people will get it. And not just assume that just because you have the idea and you explain it in a few words that it's enough to make a change.
It's I see that, you know, every time I'm preparing myself for this for any kind of speech, or for example, like, you know, tonight's webinar, when I was doing the outline, I also had to figure out, I mean, because I know this so well that I might take shortcuts, and I mustn't take shortcuts. I have to explain it very well to the people who would be exposed for the first time to this, you know, because I think that they think that, I mean, this thing that I'm saying, actually, it's so obvious, you know. I feel like embarrassed that I'm going to just be talking about such obvious things, but they're obvious to me because I've been, you know, in this industry for years. But for them, this is a new concept. Like, I'm sometimes stunned when I explain something for me, which is for me basic, for them it's like an aha moment. And it's the other way around. If somebody explains me their, you know, thing, and I'm like, whoa, this is new for me, and I'm like, and they're like, come on, this is obvious. So that's the thing. And it's hard. It's actually hard to put yourself, you know, in the recipient's shoes and actually try to just start from the beginning.
Right. This is why knowing a lot about something is not the same as being good at teaching it, right? Like, being good at something is not the same as being good at teaching it, because the way, like, knowledge we just, you know, stuff we just know is kind of structured in our minds, the way we already have all of these nodes of knowledge connecting together, it's not the same. Like, it will make no sense for other people because they don't have the foundation, they don't have the ideas like underneath and above it. So like, you have to deconstruct it and say it in a very different way, and like explain it much more than what's enough for you to explain to yourself, right? Because you already get it, right? But other people don't. It's a new idea for them.
Yeah, totally. And that's why this example with tapping was really good. I mean, it really showed me, like, you know, you see these things in your mind, but they don't, and don't assume they do.
Right. And there's this idea, you probably heard of it, called the mere exposure effect. And like it's so such a like important bias to be aware of. People like things they know. You know, exposure and familiarity causes us to like things more, right? And so again, you have to communicate your ideas much more often than you think is necessary. I mean, overexposure is a real thing, but in practice, it rarely happens, right? You'd have to try really hard to hammer people with your ideas so hard that they'd be tired of you. In reality, the way it usually happens is you mention it once or twice without explaining it properly, and you're surprised why nothing changed, yeah. Right? But so if you want to spread an idea, you have to seed it, right? You have to like just mention it briefly at first, like have the idea like seeded in people's minds, so they're exposed to it, and they expose them again and again, like, you know, 10 times maybe, and like mix it in with other stuff. Like let those ideas kind of incubate and make them familiar with them and connect them with ideas they already understand. And only then, right? Only then like pitch it and push it like for real. Once they already have the exposure and familiarity to think it makes sense that it's a good idea and not something crazy.
I think, you know, in this startup world, very often the press press was asking, you know, like a brief pitch of a brief pitch of what you're doing, like, you know, I am building a YouTube for something, you know, like I'm building an Uber for something, on Airbnb for something, so that people can relate to something, you know, to an idea, and then get what you actually want to accomplish, right? It's like you on WWDC telling people, I work for Nosby. What does Nosby do? We are Basecamp, just better, right? So like trying to make people relate to something and then, you know, pitch them the idea.
Yeah, I guess.
One of the things I think it was in this book as well, was about the group thing, right? The group think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so I was really anxious when I was reading this, listening to this chapter, because we have this. We talked about it on the show. There is an episode that we like to fight, and we have this committee of design fighters. So we every Wednesday we have a design fight, which is a meeting that we discuss the future of our application, where we discuss features, we discuss lots of things, and there is like a group, you know, a group of people, and there is the VP of product. There are two designers, the chief designer and the other designer, the VP of style. And then there's you, there's me, and there is the VP of support. So we have right. Like people from different parts of the company talking about things. And when I was reading it, when I was listening, there was this idea of groupthink. Because we respect each other, we have the same like status in the company and whatnot, that we will agree to things, we will not challenge each other. And I was questioning this and I was thinking about it. But then later in the book, it was actually explained that it's actually not true. When you have people who are comfortable with each other and are you know, are not afraid of their status in the company or their status among their peers, right. They are more likely to actually challenge each other, because they know that there's nothing at risk. They can actually, you know, challenge the ideas, because they know that the other person will also challenge the ideas. I mean, that they will actually, they're on the same footing, so they will not be afraid to really discuss and challenge each other and fight with each other. And I think this is what we have on our design fight, that we are not afraid to fight with each other, because we are not afraid of our status in the company or whatever. None of us is Donald Trump and saying you're fired. So there is no problem with that. So what happens is that we really have a nice dynamic there. And I was afraid that maybe we're doing something wrong, but it actually works. But then the book confirmed actually that what we are doing is right, and that our meeting makes sense, and we know it does, because we are not afraid to be really, to bluntly say, no, I don't agree. I think it is the other way around, or I agree, or whatever.
It's so important. You have to cultivate this culture at at your company from the very beginning that it's okay to be critical. Like it's necessary.
Exactly.
To be critical. You need to welcome critical opinions. You need to celebrate dissent, right? And like people are so much more creative when there's dissent, but there has to be this feeling that people are looking out for each other, that we're not enemies, that we're cool. Like it has to be understood. Like it's not natural for people. Most organizations are broken like that, that they can't do it. People, when people hear criticism, they think it's personal. They're criticizing me. My ideas are me. And if you want to have a creative organization that's going anywhere, it's extremely important that you separate those two, that you make it clear for everyone that we respect each other deeply on a personal level, but all of our ideas, they're not us, they're our ideas. Well, they're not even, you know, it's not that important that they're our ideas, they're just ideas. And we criticize not ourselves, we criticize our ideas and we challenge them. And we're critical of them and we like, you know, push them around and see what happens because they're just ideas. Ideas are worthless, right? It's only when you find the right one and execute it, only that's valuable, right? It doesn't matter what your status is, like whether you think your idea is great or not. Maybe it is, but it still has to be challenged. It still has to be explored and not just taken for granted. But it's predicated on the fact that you need to have everyone respect each other and understand that it's not about status, it's not about us, it's just about ideas. It's for the good of the company and not just what we thought of.
Yeah, because we really don't care whose idea was that. You know, we really don't care, you know, who was right in the end. We care if we were right in the end, accepting a good idea. And this is why I really like, you know, even the name of our meeting that is called Design Fight. Even in the name of the meeting, we encourage fighting, like really discussing things and challenging each other.
Right, right. And another one like that was this notion that ask for problems, not solutions.
Right.
Like it's completely the other way around in most organizations. Like there's this thing where when they ask like random people to fill in words in, don't give me blank, give me blank, and like everyone knew is like don't give me problems, like bring me solutions, right? But it's just so the other way around. Like you need inquiry before advocacy. Like you can't just. Like it's the same thing as what we talked about in the beginning. You can't just lock in on the first thing that comes to your mind and think that this is great, right? You have to be comfortable with the fact that no, we bring you problems. Like that's what we do. We're not perfect. We have problems, and like everyone should feel extremely comfortable with bringing problems. Like no one should feel like oh. I shouldn't mention this because I'll hurt somebody's feelings, you know, of my boss. Like if you have that in your organization, that's a broken organization, right? You have to bring problems and have, again, the idea of the problem kind of incubate and let people think about it and like let it like this procrastinate for a while if it's not urgent, to like promote divergent thinking, to have different possible solutions spring up. Don't focus on solutions too early, right? Focus on the problem and then the solution will emerge, the best solution, and not just the first solution.
I just remember, you know, like on these meetings, on our design fight, whenever Rafa, our VP of product, is driving me mad because he is always seeing an edge case, you know, an edge case scenario. So I'm like, no, I mean, I had this idea already, you know, perfectly ironed out. And then he comes with an edge case scenario, like, yes, Michael, but if this and this happens, then what do we do? And I'm like, oh, come on, don't spoil this for me, right?
Right. Right, but it's so important. Like recently we've been exploring this one idea, and I've been thinking of it, and like I've been trying to work the problem for a while. I didn't get too many solutions. What I had is a lot of questions, a lot of possible problems, possible edge cases. I just like put this big document of questions and problems and like things to think of for the whole group. I didn't have solutions. I tried and I didn't get too much, but I made this thing so that everyone could read it and like have it like be in their minds that, okay, well, like when they have an idea, how does it fare against this issue or this criterion, right? And it's so important. Like you have to do this.
Yeah, totally. And one of the things I really liked also about the book was that there were some, something relevant to me is that, you know, I have two kids and there were like things how you should cultivate originals in your kids. I mean, how help them, be original, have original ideas and cultivate the ideas with them. And one of the things was that how to cultivate empathy, and that, when a child does something correctly, don't just say, you've done it right, but like also praise the character. So you are the person who's doing things right, right? I mean, you're the person so that the child identifies, himself or herself with the character, with the badge that you're giving them. And it's a small thing, it's a small difference, right? But actually it makes sense that, don't steal because stealing is bad. Don't steal because you don't want to be a thief now, do you? Right? I mean, stealing once, come on, no pasa nada, doesn't matter.
It was kind of described as, like, the one thing is a logic of consequence versus logic of character or something like that, that it's important to convey that it's not like, oh, I shouldn't do it because if I do this thing, people might, like, there are consequences. Someone might be caught, and like then this happens or that happens. Like, but if you have this mindset of character, like, is it something that people like me do? Then like you have like more of a context of a structure that I don't do this thing because like it's who I am, right? It focuses on values, like overarching like values. That define like from which like which are like your values are like first principles from which other things naturally flow versus don't do this because X.
Yeah, and that's why like for me especially, I mean, not only with adults but especially with children, it's really important. I see my kids being really good kids, still of course they make mistakes like everyone does, but now I see how I should be speaking to them. And one of the things also mentioned in the book was something that, we've already discovered, is that the kids aren't stupid. They are small, but they aren't stupid. So treat them as not stupid people, talk to them, explain things to them, don't just say, don't do it because I say so. Tell them, don't do it because, and then, explain the situation, right, and explain how somebody else might feel if they do something wrong, or because you are not the person, that kind of person that does that, talk to them. And I find it like so refreshing. I mean, I'm so conscious about it right now. Whenever I talk to my daughters now, after I've read the book, I see the difference, in the moment I say, just don't do it, they're like, But in the moment I say, don't do it because you see, if you do that, you see what happens, and then do you think it's right? And it's a totally different reaction. Like they understand, they know where I'm coming from, and then they just stop. I mean, it works like a miracle, like magic.
And I'm glad you're aware of it because it's like so damaging. I remember like being pissed off whenever like someone in authority, like a parent or a teacher, would justify things from the position of authority, like,
yeah,
don't do this, like, just don't do this, I said so, like, don't do this because you'll be punished, right? Like it's terrible on so many levels. And when you explain, like, you actually teach your children like why, like the real reason, right? Why?
Yeah, and I'm just surprised how it works, and now that I do it, more consciously, it just works. It's good, and it also forces me to reevaluate, why, also to ask myself, before I tell it to the kid.
Mm. So the last thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up, and there's been a lot more ideas, so I really recommend reading the book. But those are just some of the best hits for us. But there's this idea that you have to motivate yourself differently when you're committed versus when you're uncertain. And this is something like me and you have been talking, kind of disagreeing on. When you, a lot of the times you were like, hey, like often at Nosby, you were like all like pessimistic and stuff. And like, hey, like, look, we're actually doing well and blah, 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 blah. But like the thing is you should approach it like differently based on how you feel, right? When your commitment is wavering, when you stop believing in yourself, like, yeah, that's what you should do. You should motivate yourself. You should look back at the progress you've already made and think of something exciting and seek encouragement from outside and be like, go, 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 right? We're doing great. But when the commitment is not wavering, when you believe in yourself, when you're set on the goal and like you are committed, you're doing it, be a pessimist. Because you mm-hmm. look at the progress that's left to be done. Like look at the, you know, be aware of the potential problems. If you're a defensive pessimist, it forces you to be aware of those potential problems, forces you to mitigate them, to prepare yourself for things that could go wrong, and then you fix them and then they don't happen, right? But not despite the fact that you're a pessimist, because of it, because you are focused on seeing the problems that might be there, right? And again, like if it like messes with you and you feel like, oh man, like everything is terrible and you stop believing in yourself, then you need encouragement. But when you are committed, you don't need more encouragement. You're already committed. So be a defensive pessimist. And be aware of all of the problems and all of the issues and like all of the weaknesses and uncertainties and threats